Welcome to Bitch Talk, booze and interview straight from the heart of San Francisco. We're back again in the good old studio, if you will, doing more ins and outs for that ass. This time, we are giving you more interview love with Rafael Cazal. And David Diggs. a blind spotting.
Yeah, it was...
I'm sweating just talking about it. My hands are sweating.
Excited about, yes. On many levels for this interview because of the film, because of them and their talent. And we were real excited for this interview.
I can't even sit still like doing this.
I know,
intro.
You keep just, like, shifting. It's
moving,
kind of making me
and
feel
grooving.
Weird.
Blindspotting is another film that takes place in the heart of Oakland, California, East Bay. And is so different than Sorry to Bother You. So different. How different is it?
In the same vein where it's just unafraid and just very bold and just doesn't hold back.
Right.
But different in its style. And both of these films are a genre of their own. So there's that. But
it's a lot of socio-political commentary, but very different. Again, very different than Sorry to Bother You. Sorry to Bother You is like heady. Like you can see it one way, or you can see it another.
It's got that like sci-fi magical
realism.
Actually, this one is kind of like
this has a little bit of
sort of. Anyway, yeah,
but different. But this is more like straight to the point. Versus Sorry to Bother You gives you this bigger, I don't know, bigger story to think about.
Right, and this one's very specific.
Blindspotting's topical.
And it's...
hella topical.
And it's a new... All right, anyway.
Just super shout out to these
so
guys.
So good.
They've been working on this script for 10 years, which is, you know, Ange and I are working on a documentary and it's only 5 years, so...
I'm already tired.
Exhausted.
Where's the white towel?
Yeah, no, but we're not.
I'm
but
just kidding. But anyway,
they worked on this for 10 years, and it shows. The film's done really well.
You're gonna want to see it 2, 3, 4 times, and I feel like every time you watch it, you're gonna catch something new.
Right, and the music's good, visuals are good. You'll see some familiar faces in there. You'll see some new faces in there, which is perfect. And if you're from the East Bay, like I am, it's super homey. So I hope you see it, even if you're not from the Bay. It talks a lot about what's happening here. And go see Blindspotting. It opens today in the Bay Area in selected theaters around the country, and then wide next week. Cazal and W. Diggs here. They're best friends, former roommates, former Berkeley High students, East Bay, born, raised, also writers and actors of the upcoming film Blindspotting. Welcome to Bitch Talk.
What?
Yeah, exactly. So feel free to curse.
Welcome to Bitch Talk.
Yes. I had a feeling you'd like that.
Using that word?
Bitch. First things first, I want to know how much the script changed over the course of 10 years, because a lot of things in the world changed in the last 10 years, but a lot of things stayed the same. So how did that reflect in your script?
How did it, Diggs?
I answered this one last time.
Oh, man, someone already asked this. We're skipping it. Next question. Go ahead.
You know, the thing that changed, I mean, the conversation around police tension and police violence changed, right? Like when we started this, Oscar Grant was this thing worthy of protests and riots and a national conversation at that moment, right? What happened over the last 10 years is that list piled so high and so frequent without any resolve or legislation change or really much evolution in the conversation, that now when it happens, we just sort of move on. Not because we don't care, but because we know what level of perfect the victim needs to be in order to try to move the needle again. It's one of the lines in the film, wrong cocktail, no protest for you, convicted felon. We're going to stay home on this one. It's not worth the energy. So I think that was it, you know, the protests don't happen. And so the script really changed to well, now the only person who's really going to be affected by it is the one person who sees it, which is, you know, David's character, Colin, and about the isolation of that experience of, like, carrying that on your own. And that was, I think that's the biggest move the script made.
Yeah. But not only, it didn't only change throughout the course of these 9 years, but while you were filming, you say that certain lines, and if it didn't feel right for a character, it was very much collaboration between you and your crew, or your cast.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. I think once you cast somebody, that's theirs now, right? And you're sort of, your job as an actor, I think, is to know more about your character than anyone else, particularly an ensemble piece, because there's so many moving pieces, right? So, you know, if an actor comes up to either one of us and be like, I don't know why I would say this, or the person that I have developed wouldn't say this, you got to listen to that. If you cast the right people, then you have to listen to that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've internalized the character deeper than you have at this point, you know?
Mm-hmm. So the finished product came out a lot differently than it was on paper initially?
Well, I think that's always true of a film. Once the thing, you make a film three times, in the writing and the shooting and in the edit. I mean, I think actors did things that were interesting and nuanced that aren't always on paper. And so you get in the cut and you go, well, they gave this facial expression that's super interesting. Let's pair it with this reaction. And I don't know that the version of it that was on paper in the way that I saw it in my head is how it looks. It's better. It's so much better. Mm. You do so much with the space in between lines in a film. And so we loved it, dialogue and description. But Robbie and Carlos and our amazing team on the ground then injected it with all of their nuance and love and brilliance, and so the end result is so much larger than the sum of its parts.
A little bit about Monster, because I read in the notes that Jess Calder, one of the biggest producers of this film, called that sort of the origin of Blindspotting.
That's the title of I think the first poem that she saw me do, which was the catalyst for this music album. But that poem was a response to a good friend of mine when I was about 19, 20. A female friend of mine was killed in Berkeley, up by Cal. She was shot after a party up there. And I had already been through a lot of funerals at that point, a lot of people who had passed away from gun violence and shit in the Bay Area. And I remember being there at the site where it happened, and then also at the funeral with a bunch of the men that I grew up with who'd seen even more of that violence than I had. And I remembered the numbness. The poem is about the numbness of violence. Mm-hmm. When it's in abundance, how easy it is to callous over and get used to it, right? We get used to problematic things like that. And at a certain point, you don't realize how used to it you are because you're living in the experience. So that poem is about feeling like a monster because I'm looking at things that in my mind should trigger sadness and crying, and I'm seeing people crying. Mm-hmm. Then I'm seeing a row of men behind me that were joking and laughing, and like, humor is paired with sadness, that's natural. Right. But there's a disconnect to the violence that starts to happen after a while. Again, I think that speaks to, we managed to still pull that into the film. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That concept of even Miles and his proximity to Colin. Miles isn't desensitized to violence. He wields violence. He knows its impact. He knows the value of it, you know, mm-hmm. and the harshness of it. He's reactionary because he is in many ways very much afraid of violence. But even him, right next to Colin, who's experienced this incredibly violent, traumatic thing, because he didn't see it, it just doesn't wear on him, mm-hmm. you know. I think that numbness is sort of where we're at as a country. Like
every day
where we have trauma fatigue. We're watching the news and we see a thing and I like, it just doesn't bother me. anymore, and that is what bothers me now.
Right.
You have to pick what's bothering you.
Well, because you're trying to survive. You're trying not to just cry all day.
I remember when the Florida shooting happened, I avoided it for like a week. And I'm not even ashamed of that. That's like not my fault. Like, come on, country, do something. I don't have the emotional capacity for this. Which means that like our defense mechanism is to get numb. I think that that's the right thing for us as people to do to save for our own mental health. But it's also a really dangerous place for us to be swinging into. That poem was about wanting to like remind myself to feel, because the conscious decision to feel, because the unconscious decision is to remove and to callous. And the whole movie is that. Lean in to feel.
Well, that's one of the things that I really love about the film is, of course, you capture that the tension and the anxiety that comes with living in the city. But you also, there's also so much beauty and laughter. And David, I think in an interview you said, like, just because we grew up poor doesn't mean that we were sad all the time. I think you did such a great job of capturing those two worlds.
Yeah. I mean, there's, economics don't have anything to do really with happiness, right? I mean, you know, you find that in your family, real or created. And so, you know, one of the things I love so much about the film, we watched it last night for the first time in a long time. I haven't actually sat through it in a long time. Miles and Colin, as brothers, essentially, like, bring each other so much joy and, like, are responsible for that. Like, it's their responsibility, right? When one of them is not okay, you tell a joke, like, because that's your job as a friend, to make sure that the situation is infused with joy. And I think that's a beautiful thing. And I think particularly in, like, economically depressed communities, you lean on that even heavier. Because the material things that we distract ourselves with aren't as readily available, right? So we use each other, and we use humor, and we, you know, it's a coping mechanism, but a particularly healthy one, I think.
We only have like a few minutes, which makes me sad already.
Oh, what?
But I want to ask you how you guys feel about Oakland, Berkeley, San Francisco, Bay Area now, as opposed to growing up, because I have to say we're all mainly locals, born and raised here, and it's rough for me day to day to live here and see the changes. How do you guys feel when you come back and visit?
It's really jarring.
Yeah.
I mean, I watched it happen at Berkeley first, early. So Berkeley's been gone to me. When people talk about Berkeley, I'm like, I do not know the city you are relating to.
In what ways, if you don't mind me asking?
I mean, it was such like a lefty, like a super uber lefty alternative, you know, community of people that were so open-minded and so accepting. And now what it feels like with my just a few years I lived in the Midwest and have traveled around the country, feels like the people who were sort of left for where they're from heard about Berkeley and moved there for some of the bells and whistles of the city. But it's really not that, it's not that progressive. There's an idea of Berkeley now that was Berkeley in like the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. But I mean, just the stats of the demographics of the city have shifted so drastically, and the economics of, I mean, my parents bought their house in Berkeley for like 110K maybe, you know, but nothing, like, and it was not nice. I remember I asked my mom once, I was like, why are there like circles in the intersection?
Oh, right, yeah, the roundabouts.
Well, no, they added the roundabouts. These were tire marks. Tire marks, these are ways that we stop and we push out certain people, you know.
That's what they were replaced. Sure that they,
yeah, the roundabouts came to stop people from doing donuts.
I did not know that. You know, okay.
That's why you gotta go around. You can't hit your shit. You know, and I remember the shifting of the titles of the neighborhoods. Like, I live firmly in North Berkeley now. That was West Berkeley my whole life. You know, up until like 12 or 13, and then it changed to, because it was better for the selling of the houses. And how Berkeley can you be parade went away. And the city got strict in ways that it was really uncomfortable, and then everyone from Berkeley couldn't live there anymore, and they moved to Oakland, right? That's why I rep Oakland so hard. That's mm-hmm. where everybody I knew, I mean, all my friends were from Oakland and Berkeley, except all the Berkeley ones left and live in the town now, and now mm-hmm. everyone is getting pushed out of the town.
Right.
Like, I'm following my people. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm repping where my people are. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I give a shit about the city limits. I'm repping my community of people. Yeah. That's why growing up in those two cities, it was so important. But Washington, Berkeley, and Oakland, and San Francisco now, it's a story of watching a family member die in mm-hmm. a way. You know, the film for us a lot was like time capsuling. Mm-hmm. It's like mm-hmm. The fear of it. There's optimism there too, but the fear of it is in 20 years when I want to explain to my children mm-hmm. or to other people that I love and know what it was like to be where we're from. We had nothing to show them that mm-hmm. that showed what it was like. Mm-hmm. So a lot of this was, I want to show you who the people were. What the town was, what mm-hmm. it felt like, how they talked, how we hung, how we played, how we partied, before it was gone.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a, I don't know, being in San Francisco is a trip, right? I mean, if you ever spend any time here before, because it's like, it's unrecognizable, and it's a product of a completely shattered middle class, right?
It's oh, yeah.
so expensive to live here that you is. You're wealthy or you're homeless, right? That's it. And so mm-hmm. There's a weird kind of the way that culture is sort of covered over through the gentrification process is like it's about making something for mass production, right? It's about mm-hmm. a samening of everything. Mm-hmm. It's why Berkeley didn't feel like Berkeley anymore. Mm-hmm. It's why Oakland feels like it's slipping away. It's because in order to make something to attract people from everywhere, right? You make it's network TV, right? It's like mm-hmm. that's what we're doing to these cities, mm-hmm. making them as palatable to the masses as possible. How many Whole Foods and Starbucks,
Chipotle, and Subway is also
Subway's too, yeah.
So because this is something that is everybody's taste, right? Like and nobody's taste. It is no taste. It is not a choice.
Right.
And that's what I think sometimes in the interest of bringing finance in, we're going for it. One of the reasons it's important to do things like make movies and mm-hmm. and do sort of cultural work that highlights the city, but also is our shot in the cities because that is an influx of income. That's actually a revenue stream that is investing in the thing that's already there.
Yeah.
Right.
And does not rely on new people coming in. It's revenue because of what it looks like and mm-hmm. what it is right now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's another reason we shot in the town. It's another reason I'm so happy so many people are starting to. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I just want to thank you guys for making this film.
Like a bitch talk specific question.
Those were it.
Okay. Seemed pretty calm.
That was our interview with Rafael Cazal, David Diggs at Blind Spotting. Writers and actors of this film.
Huh. First of all,
we have to tell you how this interview went.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. First of all, we only get 15 minutes, right. Which
it's nothing.
It sucks no matter who you're interviewing.
I'm not complaining. No, but
it goes too fast, especially when you're interviewing two people, because you could have 15 minutes with each of them in their own right, and it wouldn't have been enough, but let alone both of them at the same time. We're sitting there in the interview, and it was great, and we were getting into these really deep, heartfelt, mm-hmm. emotional issues that the film touches upon. And, just to give you a little visual, how we were seated around this round table it was David Diggs, Rafael Cazal, myself, and then Aaron. So I was in the middle, so I was mostly looking to the left. So all I could see was Rafael and David.
I would like to reference that if you just go to our Instagram page, it's a Bitch Talk Podcast, you can find this photo. So there's a setup
You can find photographic proof of
the story
that we're telling you
right
now.
And then you can follow along with the story. Anyway.
Yeah. So Rafael gave, in the beginning, first half of the interview, Rafael was speaking more than David, which is fine. You know, they kind of took turns. So I would be listening to Rafael. Very deep
intently,
conversation. Yep. He was saying really thoughtful, emotional things. And then I would just kind of feel some eyes on me and I'd peer to the right and just catch eyes with David Diggs.
Right.
And if you don't know what this man looks like, those eyes...
You call them cow intense cow eyes.
Intense cow eyes. Like soft and gentle, but intense.
Right.
Like kind of like looking through you. And I didn't know that he was doing the same thing to Aaron until we left the interview. And I was like, oh man, I was kind of distracted because I would like catch eyes with him halfway through the question and get all distracted.
Right.
And he was doing the same thing to you.
Yeah, it was distracting. And we're trying to really be in the moment, but it was real hard.
I didn't mind, but it was just really funny. Like, we'd meet eyes and I'd be like, oh shit, wait, pay attention. Go back to the left. You know? Like, yeah. But then Aaron made up a good point. We were trying to think of like, what was he thinking? Why was he looking at us so intensely?
Why was it intense?
Because normally when you're in an interview, you look at the person who's speaking.
Right.
You know, at least not the whole time. You don't stare at the other two people.
Right, right. You're not looking at the other two while this other person's talking.
Right. So we came up with some good
theories. So I was like, did he think that we were sisters? Like, he couldn't figure out what our relationship was with the same haircut.
Yeah, he's like, are they sisters? Are they scissor sisters?
Ew, no. It's not a Jess May Peloso interview. But
we're like, why do they have similar haircuts?
That's right. Like, I really wish we were like, do you have questions for us? We should have just asked that question at the end.
No, my favorite part was how, you know, like we always, you know, we have the 15 minutes, right? And then usually the publicist or somebody from their team usually kind of gives me the cue of like, okay, you have 5 minutes left. Mm-hmm. I'm usually on time to keep us on time and like kind of get us where I'm giving you guys cues a minute or two earlier so that we don't squeeze into other people's times.
Right. And I always ignore you because I get mad when you tell me.
She had no idea. Anyways, that's a whole other thing.
Well, I was like, I didn't know.
Well,
I was busy locking eyes with David Diggs. Sorry.
And she never pays attention to my, because she gets mad at me when I give her the cue. Like I go, oh, you've got 3 minutes. And you're like, that's it. I'm done.
Well, and I just want to tell you, when I used to do that job and when you're a publicist, the people that stay on time are kind of your favorites. The people that lag and keep asking questions and just think that they can stay in the room, that you're like, I don't ever want to have them.
No.
Here's the thing. I get mad, but I still stay within time, but I still get mad.
Yeah. No, but like for me, and as always being that person.
I appreciate it.
I always like Erin knows this from, you know, when she was in that world, that the first thing that I always ask the publicist is, what's my absolute hard out so that I know how to time you guys and give you guys, I even give you, you know, an extra 2 or 3 minutes. I start cueing you, I start wrapping you guys a couple minutes early to make sure that I've got you guys out by that hard out. That's why when you're like, it's over already, I thought I had 12 minutes. Right. And it's like, you know, we're 8 minutes in. But anyways, I was kind of I'm keeping time, and then our publicist comes in, and usually because we're in the room by ourselves, so he comes in, gives me the high sign to kind of warn me. So then I start giving you guys your little rap cues, your twos, your threes, all that.
I'm watching.
You know, like I'm pulling the curtain for our listeners. It's like that's kind of how these interviews work.
Right.
Is, you know, we're allotted time, and then I'm the timekeeper of making sure that we don't piss anybody off.
Yep.
And so the best part was, or the funniest part was when I was trying to get you guys to rap.
Yes.
And then you guys were trying to do your last question.
Yep.
And David, who for the most part, Raphael was the one who was kind of dominating the interview. And then at the very end, he decided to speak up. And then he had like the longest.
And it was great what
answer.
He was saying.
It was, no, it was, yeah. It was actually really poignant and it was really good.
And it was a perfect close for the interview.
Yeah, it was really good content. But then I got, like, I was giving raps like minutes ago.
I know,
like,
you were.
Besides me. Like,
then the publicist.
The publicist
in
walked in when it was supposed to be
there.
Over, and we're just like, I'm like, ah!
Yeah.
That was the funniest part. And then I didn't even know about the big eye staring thing. And then you guys mentioned it to me, and then I looked at, and then you guys said send me the pictures, and I looked at the pictures, and I was like, oh, there.
Like every photo, it's either him looking at me or her. And it's,
I'm not mad.
No,
thank you, but you know, it was a little distracting. That's all I'm going to say.
Right. One other thing I want to say is thank you, David Diggs, for following Bitch Talk Podcast on Instagram, because he has over 400,000 people that follow him, so he doesn't have to follow anybody.
Right.
But yeah, that was...
and that, anyway, back to the, yes, the interview and blind spotting. We just touched the surface with these questions. Yep. We had so much more to ask them, but I hope you see this film and support it because it's so important. And they having a big opening weekend means mm-hmm. that they get to make more films,
right?
And it's so important. Their voice is so unique, mm-hmm. and they need to be supported. It's
and
incredible.
we did something a little bit different this time around. We actually had a film crew with us.
All
so
right.
We're probably gonna have at least a clip or two.
Oh wow! So we'll have
oh, we'll still
video
have eyes
evidence.
On us.
We'll have video.
On video.
We'll actually see how that goes. Yeah, yeah. We'll see how that goes.
Oh, that's so.
It was a one shot though, so I don't know.
I know.
If we had too bad, we didn't have the two
shot. I think
shot.
It would be incredible if you can tell, like each of us
darting,
taking turns,
darting,
like looking
darting,
and then going
darting.
Back. And looking.
If we had the two shot, that would be awesome.
Put that in the budget for next time.
Oh, man.
We'll ask Annika. That's what I mean.
We'll see how many man grates we sold. Maybe we'll have enough for...
Forget it. Forget about the... Forget that. What are you talking about? Anyways, go support Blindspotting. Thank you, Lionsgate, for having us. This is a big film for them. Thank you to Pete's Coffee. They didn't give us coffee, but they're heavily supporting Blindspotting, and they're a local company, so you should drink their coffee. And we will see you soon.
Bitch, please.